I want to go back before I to set up what I want to talk about a little bit more today. I want to go back to the call to worship in Matthew 5, 13 through 15. As I was preparing for my message this morning, this text came to me, and it seemed like a text that would be appropriate to set up what, you know, this larger theme that I really want us to continue to address. So if you have your Bibles and you want to turn to Matthew 5, verses 13 through 15, that would be great. And this is Jesus speaking. This is part of his Sermon on the Mount, which was his opus. It was the core, the central teaching of what he had to say. I mean, when he spoke on the Sermon on the Mount or the Sermon on the Plain, everything that he did after that followed that particular teaching, and so. These are among his most significant words, the Sermon on the Mount and the Sermon on the Plain. But in Matthew, this is known as the Sermon on the Mount. So we read here in Matthew 5, 13 through 15, "You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house." So as you consider that particular text, I just want to make a few comments on that. Let's say salt, for example. Let's say you're traveling and you go to some place in a different part of the world. And you're sitting at a table in a restaurant and you're eating. And somebody in the next table you overhear say that they really aren't enjoying their food because it's very bland. And ironically enough, you live in a place where they don't know anything about salt for seasoning food with. I mean, there were places like that in the world at one time where they did not know about salt. And so, you know, you lean over and say, "Look, I wasn't trying to overhear your conversation, but I heard you say that your food was very bland and you've grown weary of your food being bland all the time. Have you ever heard of salt? In our country, we use salt to season our food." And they say, what is that?" And you say, "Well, it's this white rock that's ground up, and you put it on your food." "Well, what does it taste like?" "Well, it's salty." So they ask you to describe what it tastes like, and you can't describe it. The only way that you can know what salt is like is if you experience it, right? It's the only way. It's the only way you can know what salt is like, because you can't describe it. It's really kind of indescribable. Well, keep that in mind. Let's take the next passage. Let's say, for example, that in some weird place that there is only darkness and there are people who live in that darkness. And you enter into that and you bump into them, because you could only bump into them because you can't see them. And you say, "You know, in my world, we have this thing called light." And they say, "Well, what is light? I've only lived in darkness my entire life. What is light? Would you describe it to me?" How do you describe light to someone who has lived in darkness their entire life? What would you say? "Well, it's like this bright thing." "Well, what is bright?" "Well, it means you can see." "Well, I can't see." "What does it mean to see?" So Jesus is using this very poignant metaphor. And he's really saying that for people, for you and I to be light, the only way, I'm sorry, for us to be salt, the only way that people can experience us as salt or know what salt is to experience the Christ-likeness in us that is salt. It's the only way. You can describe to them all you want to, but it's pretty meaningless. And the same is true of light. For people who live in darkness their entire life, and there are people who live in darkness their entire life, and if you try to describe to them Jesus as light, it is meaningless to them. It doesn't make sense. There are very few points of contact. What would they draw from? Especially when we live in this world where there's a significant counter message to what religion and faith and God and the church really are. They're tempted to believe that what you're telling them is a lie. It doesn't exist. You are deluded. And so what would it be like then to encounter a person who lives in darkness and you try to describe to them intellectually what light is? So a person who has lived only in darkness and regards it as normal cannot comprehend light. The only way they can experience that or know it or understand it is if they actually see light in the darkness in which they live. I'll give you another example. What would it be like? Imagine having a doctor who can only tell you all about the human body, ailments, and diseases, but never examines, treats, or prescribes medications. So let's say you went to a doctor and said, "Hey, I'm having this thing." And the doctor can pontificate beautifully what's wrong, you know, everything about your body, that disease or that ailment. And then you're like, "Okay, what are we going to do about this?" But they don't treat you. They don't examine you. They don't give you any medication. Would that doctor be worth much to you? Not at all. Because what he did basically was he gave you theory. And so I think that too many of us are theorists rather than practitioners. We theorize when we talk about being salt. We theorize when we talk about being light. We theorize like that doctor who knows everything about the human body, but doesn't prescribe, treat, or give medications. Does this make sense to you? The only way that the people in this world in which we live can experience Jesus Christ in terms of us being salt is for them to taste Christ in our life, to experience the actual thing, is to experience light in our life, in the darkness of their world. It's the only way. It's the only way. So I want to say this. The godly family is the primary means of production for salt and light within our decaying and dark world. The godly family is the primary means of production for salt and light within our decaying and dark world. We can talk intellectually who Jesus is every time we encounter a person. But if they don't actually see who Jesus is, if they don't actually in a palpable way experience who Jesus is, the love of Christ through our life, the understanding, the kindness, the care, the support, the encouragement, if they don't experience the justice of God in our life, His holiness in our life, it's all theory. It's all theory. And so what we probably need to do better is to be practitioners. And if we're going to be practitioners, then we have to understand that everyone in this room has family in some capacity. And as such, we are, our family, the whole idea of family is what is it, that is the means of production for salt and light in the world in which we live. So if our families are not producing salt and light, then we can't be in this world what we ought to be. And we should not be surprised if the world rejects our theory of who God is and the claims that Jesus has made about himself. We should not be surprised because they haven't seen Christ. They haven't tasted Christ. They haven't experienced Christ driving back the darkness in their life. They don't see Christ having driven back the darkness in our life because we are theorists too often. So now we come to Joshua 24. Because Joshua is talking about this declaration about himself and his family. And so this is where we come to, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And this is really part two of that I want to carry on from last Sunday about what it means for family to live in Kairos time, especially this time that we live in now. So just going back to Psalm 90:12, a text that I've repeated at least five or six times these last five or six Sundays, teach us to number our days aright, that we may gain a heart of wisdom. So I've repeated this text many times. And in repeating it, I guess I'm assuming that you may understand the significance of this text and you may have wrestled with it. But I want to ask you this question. Who here has wrestled with, over these last few weeks that I've used this text, who here has wrestled with, teach us to number our days all right? That when I used that text on a Sunday, you went home and said to yourself, I need to make a better account of the way in which I'm living my life. I need to pray that God would teach me and show me and illuminate within my heart how I could make better use of the time that God has given to me. All of us heard earlier when Rocky said, I'm out of time, okay? And some of us interpreted that like, oh no, what happened, right? And so because then we were struck with the poignancy of what it means that you have no days left. So if you have no days left, then you can't do any more. And then you thought, well, I haven't done enough. So I need more time so I can do more. Who here has gone home after hearing this text and asked the Lord, teach us to number our days aright, that we may gain a heart of wisdom? So anybody here? Raise your hands. Good. I would say you need to do that. And, you know, just sort of going back to, you know, the salt and light metaphor. How can I be a brighter light? How can I be more salty than what I am? And so I want to say to you, you know, as I was talking last week about the two different kinds of time that the Greeks talked about, Chronos and Kairos. And I talked about how we probably are in a stage of our nation's history and a point in time in this world where it's very much a Kairos time. And I am saying to you, as strongly as I know how, that part of this Kairos time that we live in necessarily means paying much greater attention to what is going on in the life of our families. Because the family really is the building block of any society, any culture, any church. Any. If you can corrupt the family, you can corrupt anything else. If you can minimize the family, you can minimize. If you marginalize the family, you can marginalize anything else. The family is the nodal point upon which all other things are built, upon which all other things thrive. Destroy the family, and you destroy anything that family is connected to or that families are connected to. We are in a Kairos time. And I think that it's time for us to dig our heels in, to put the brakes on, to reevaluate how we are as parents to our children, how we are as aunts and uncles to our nephews and nieces, how we are as grandparents to our grandchildren, how we are as spiritual parents here in this church to the children who go to this church, how this church can continue to maintain itself in terms of its impact with what we do in that preschool, because we exert a kind of parental spiritual leadership to those children. We are in a Kairos time. There's no other way to put it. We can no longer afford to ignore it. There are no other agencies out there that will support our parental values, our spiritual values. They do not exist. It used to be that you could depend on the schools to support, to undergird what you believed in terms of your values. You cannot do that anymore. In fact, in most places, it runs counter to that. They resent the impact that parents have on the kids and how you are countering what they are teaching your children. Not everybody. We have some wonderful educators out there who fight it. God bless them. Right? But I am saying that one of the responses that we have to this world is what it is that we do with our families, and that we can no longer afford to be lax or relaxed about that any longer. So, to faithfully make the best use of Kairos time, we must first rid ourselves of current and competing idols, or those idols from our former life. And this is the discussion that takes place in Joshua 24. So, if you want to turn to Joshua 24, let's just spend some time unpacking that text so that we understand what's really going on. Because Joshua 24:15, as I said before, is a passage of scripture that's become quite well known, but I don't think that we understand what the praxis of that passage really is. Praxis means taking theory and making it work in real life. You have this guess about how things are, and then you think, well, if that's how things are, then this is how I'm going to make that work in my life. So let's turn to Joshua 24, where he begins in verse 1, I'm sorry, let me get my notes here. So we see here in, what is that, verse 15? 14, thank you. Because I don't have my glasses. This has been a beautiful day. So I'll just rely on my notes here. So we are going to begin with Joshua 14. Let me get my notes here. This is kind of embarrassing for me to do this. But we read here what kind of is a covenantal formula. And so, keep going, Bree, if you would. So Joshua is basically, he understands that something big is about to happen. The main three people who have brought them out of Egypt and into the promised land are about to, Joshua is the last one. Aaron died, then Moses, now Joshua is the last one. And he's trying to leave them with this Kairos moment. That look, if you are going to enter into the promised land and you are going to conquer it and make it yours as Yahweh wants you to, then these are the things that you must do. These are the things that you must do. And so we read here, beginning with verse 14, where there are four principles that he wants them to adopt. Reverence, respect, where he says, fear the Lord. He says, so the first thing I want you to do is I want you to fear the Lord. And what he means by fear the Lord is reverence, respect, and even fear. And those three things are all kind of different from each other. To have reverence for or to revere is to have, this thing becomes incredibly special. You set it apart. It isn't like anything else. That you respect it. You won't do anything that debases it. And that there's good reason even to fear the Lord. You know, we read in Matthew 10:28 where he says, "And do not fear those who kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. Rather, fear him who can destroy both soul and body in hell." There are some people who think you ought not to fear God. You really ought to fear God. And it's not that that should be the primary way in which we approach God, but there is this component about God that if we aren't obedient to him, if we don't repent from our sin, then we have every good reason in the world to fear God. So Joshua is saying to the people, fear the Lord. Above all, revere him. That he is the most special of anything else that you have in your life. Respect him. Do not debase. And fear him as well. The next principle he talks about is serve. Fear and then serve. Recognize and submit to his worthiness and lordship. That you know, the whole built into that whole idea of serving is that a servant has a master or a lord who is over him. And that master and lord does not have a servant without that servant having a purpose. A very clear purpose. So if Joshua is saying, I want you to serve him, then you have to understand your purpose as a servant. And that goes back to teach us to number our days aright, O Lord, in order that we may have a heart of wisdom. We know how we're supposed to use this time that he has given to us. I mean, really, if you go back all the way back then, and you have this idea that servants or that masters could be pretty harsh, and that most masters were pretty frugal. Do you think masters had servants running around the house who had no purpose? You think he fed them and clothed them and housed them just so that they could frolic around the house and do nothing? Absolutely not. Every servant they had a specific purpose. And it's not that the Lord doesn't want us to frolic. He wants us to frolic and have fun and experience pleasure and joy. But that's all part of our overarching purpose that he has as his servants for our life. Do we know what that is? Is that clear to us? The third principle he talks about is sincerity. So that we serve the Lord with sincerity. Not out of duty, but desire. Desire. We've all had people who were in authority over our life that we had great respect for, and they would ask us to do something, and we couldn't do it for them fast enough. Right? Haven't you all had people like that in your life? You wanted to please them because you had great respect for them. And so what you really wanted to hear from them was, hey, great job. Thank you for doing that. And it just does so much for us in terms of who we are. We feel like we have some purpose. So our degree of sincerity is directly proportionate to our degree of respect for God. If we really desire to serve him, the degree of that desire is in proportion to the degree of respect that we have for God. If we have little respect, we'll have little desire. And then maybe we fall back on duty, and at which point that sometimes we patronize God. Do you ever patronize God? I've patronized God. I've done things for God just because I'm supposed to do it. Not because I want to, but just because I'm supposed to. And I'm not sure how much pleasure God derives from that. And I certainly don't derive much pleasure for it myself. The fourth one is faithfulness. And that means fidelity and trust. And what fidelity means is that there are no others. So when we get married in the marriage covenant, the word fidelity oftentimes comes up. And when we say fidelity, it means that we are marrying this person, this spouse, and there will be no others. There's fidelity. There's exclusiveness. And so Joshua is, the last principle that he gives to them here is, I want you to be exclusive in who you worship. And I want you to trust him only in terms of what you need in life. So right off the bat, in Joshua 24:14, there are these four principles and these principles are very poignant. They are among the most important words that Joshua says. He is about to die. He brings together his last speech before the nation of Israel, and those are the four things that he highlights. This is what you need in order to be successful as a nation. And I would say this, we need those four things to be successful as families, and we need those four things to be successful as a church. If we don't have those four things, we're probably not going to be successful. So here are the four principles as a list. Fear the Lord, serve the Lord, be sincere before the Lord, be faithful to the Lord. Now imagine if we took our prayer time each week and we said, Lord, help me to know how I can reverence you better. Help me to know how I could respect you more. Help me to see those things in my life that should cause fear in my life because of how they dishonor you, and how they are evidence of my disobedience. Or you could pray, Lord, show me the ways in which you want me to serve you. How can I serve my family? How can I serve in my community? How can I serve at work? Even though I'm paid there, how can I serve in a way that gives you glory? Lord, how can I be sincere? Show me ways in which I am insincere to you. Show me how I patronize you with my life, and that I do things only out of a sense of duty. Ignite in my heart ways in which what I do for you, it's out of desire because I respect you and I love you and I appreciate what you do for me. Everybody here intellectually could tell me why God ought to be respected and loved and served. But could you say, out of your experience, why all those things should be? And then, I think, and very poignantly here, very purposefully, Joshua talks about the word faithful. Be faithful to the Lord. And why is that? Because the next phrase is this: put away the gods. Put away those things that make fidelity impossible. So he uses the word faithfulness right before this next clause. Put away the gods that you brought with you that were a part of Abraham's life when he came from Ur of Chaldee and stayed with us as a people. Put away the gods that were in Egypt that you brought with you. Put away the gods that are currently a part of the Canaanite people that you've become. You've begun to entertain in your life. Put away all those idols, all those gods. Put them away. Destroy them. Eliminate them. Forget them. And so we know that when we read the Old Testament, especially 1st and 2nd Kings, 1st and 2nd Chronicles, we know that that was the thing that troubled Israel their entire existence. They never ultimately put away those idols and those gods. And those gods and those idols infected their lives and made it impossible for them to live as they should have lived. It corrupted their families. And it destroyed their culture and society because they never ended up putting away their gods. And so then Joshua very, very forcefully says, look, I just told you to put away your gods, but look, if you think that it is evil in your eyes to serve the Lord only, then choose this day whom you will serve. He's putting it right before him. And so I would say to us right now, I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit, but I'll say this. Everyone in this room, if you are human, right now, this past week, this past year, you have struggled with certain idols in your life. Fear, materialism, whatever it is. There are certain idols in our lives. And they rise up and become more prominent during certain seasons or times. And they contend with control over our heart and mind, over our actions. So while we may not have little idols in our house like the Israelites did, we still have other kinds of idols that we worship, that we attend to, that get in the way, and that corrupt our families, and our church, and our society. The parallels are all here. I'm not inventing anything here. It's all here. Choose this day whom you will serve. So next Sunday, we're going to have a bit of a covenantal renewal. In these words here, choose this day whom you will serve. I'm going to ask you. And then Joshua concludes his statement and says, but for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And so Joshua makes a public declaration of his fidelity and the leadership in his home. And so here are the principles behind this statement, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Let me ask you this question. When somebody who is an unbeliever walks into your home, is the spirit, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord, present? When they walk into your home, are they confronted in a good way with that spirit of, but as for me and my house, we will serve. They know your house belongs to the Lord, not just your building, but your family. Do they know that? When you have conversations with people from work, or maybe a teacher, or maybe a neighbor, and they are advising you, or they assume certain things about you, your life, your values that run counter to who you are. When they have that experience, do they have this experience where what comes back at them is, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord? Not in an arrogant sort of way, but just this powerful kind of poignant spiritual response. So these are the principles in that particular passage that I think are worth looking at for a moment. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. It is a public, even defiant declaration. He is standing before all of Israel. He has seen their infidelity, their waffling, their rationalizations. And regardless of that, he says, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. It is a public and even defiant declaration. The second thing is he establishes and undergirds spiritual leadership for his home. He takes responsibility for the spiritual leadership in his home. It's not the youth minister. It's not the pastor. It's not uncle this or aunt that or grandfather this or grandfather that. He takes responsibility for what is going on in his home spiritually. And so it implies that faithful families equal a faithful Israel. So I will say the same to you. Faithful families equal a faithful church. A church is only as strong as the families are within that church. And we have to get stronger. Because the tsunami that is headed our way is a very strong tsunami. And we can prevail. But we have to get stronger. This is the Kairos time in our life. Now, just very quickly, in a rhetorical fashion, the people's response is, "Far be it that we should forsake the Lord." And then they begin to give this, and the reason why we can't forsake the Lord, and they give this history about how God has been faithful to them. And after they give that history, they conclude again, "We will serve the Lord." So Joshua hears them. Then Joshua gives them a rhetorical challenge back. "You aren't able to serve the Lord. Why?" And he goes on to say, "Because God is holy and he is jealous. And you will do things that will debase his holiness. And you will do things that will make him jealous." And then Joshua comes back around again and he says, "If you forsake God and serve idols, he will turn and do you harm and consume you." And so he warns them about that particular thing. Now, I see again that I'm out of time, and I want to finish this portion. I may pick it back up again just to tie this part back off. But I just want to say to you, look, I want to go back to those four things where he says, where he talks about fearing the Lord, about serving him, about being sincere, and about being faithful. Wrestle with those this week. Wrestle with those this week. The second thing I want to say is about Joshua. What kind of a family are you going to be? Decide this week. Are you willing to make a public, confident, maybe even defiant declaration that you will serve the Lord? Will you be people in your own home who will exercise spiritual leadership? So that not only will you be found faithful before the Lord, but in your faithfulness in your families, you become light and you become salt, and you help make this church even bigger and better and stronger than what we are now. We must prepare ourselves. We have to prepare ourselves. And I'm telling you, as sincerely as I know how, this is the Kairos moment, and we have to get ready to meet it faithfully and powerfully.